Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guests, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Joe Calloway with us, the author of The Art of Attracting Business. Joe helps great companies even better. He helps organizations, top-performing individuals, to focus on what's truly important, inspires constant improvement, and motivates people to immediate action. He's a business author, an advisor, a speaker. He's a corporate client list reads like a who's who in business, ranging from companies like Coca-Cola and IBM to Cadillac and American Express. And let us say, Joe, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, just the title itself, The Art of Attracting Business. Joe, one of the greatest analogies I've ever heard about that would be something to the effect of this. You're going to have this great party. You spend all this money on having the great party, and then you wonder why nobody shows up. Well, somebody forgot to invite anybody.
Yeah. And, well, actually, the one-word title above that is magnetic. And,
yeah.
And you're right. The thing is, not only do some businesses, they're not inviting people, and they're certainly not attracting people. So that's kind of what the book is about, but your analogy is right on the money.
You know, when you come down to it, do most businesses, and you've been around a long time, do most businesses even know how to attract that business that they're looking for?
You know, here's the thing. They all certainly want to, and everybody says all the right things. Here's the problem. Here's what's missing. And I love a word that you use in describing your show and the lead-in that I was listening to, which is the word clarity.
Yeah.
Most businesses fail to get clarity on the handful of things that if they do those things with excellence and do them consistently, then they will attract customers. What they're lacking is being truly intentional every day about the execution of those. And I think this is a key. Those very few things, you don't have to do 100 things. You have to do 3 or 4 things to make your business work and attract customers.
Now, Joe, I'm going to ask you a loaded question, okay?
And sure.
It's a tough question to answer. But
okay.
And as long as you've been around, as long as I've been around, most businesses that you run into, do they know what they're selling?
You know, here's, I think, the problem. They know what they're selling from their perspective.
Yes.
But they don't have enough insight on what they're selling from the customer's perspective. And it's funny, you know, you just hit on something that I really talk about quite a bit in one particular chapter in the book, which is you haven't thought it through from the customer's perspective and from the perspective of what true value am I delivering to the person that I'm asking to give me their money. And so, yeah, I think you hit on a really important point. They have their own idea of what they're selling, but the market says, you know, I know you're excited about it, but we're not.
Yeah, and that's the whole point. When it comes down to it, great analogy. I've worked out all my life in gyms. You go into a gym, you want to join. So they show you this machine, which is a feature. The benefit of the machine is going to give you a big bicep. So
yeah.
They sell you the bicep. Well, nobody ever asked me what I wanted the big bicep for. It was to go out on the beach and impress the girls. Don't sell me the machine. Don't sell me the bicep. Sell me the beach.
It's funny. I was talking to a group of high school students. Hey, Michael, this was decades ago. And I said, how many of you love geometry, love algebra, love chemistry? And, of course, they were all booing. And I said, how many of you think that it doesn't make any sense to take geometry because you'll never use it? And they all said, that's right. I said, let me ask you this. And I went over to a bunch of guys. I said, how many of you guys work out? and a bunch of them raised their hands. I said, do you work out to be good at working out? Why do you work out? And one of them shouts out, to get girls. So I'll look good and I'll get girls. I said, right. That's why you take geometry. It's not to do geometry. It's to learn how to think so you'll be able to do other things. But, yeah, you're exactly right. People are selling the wrong thing.
You know, and there's also a mindset out there that's got to be stopped. And I don't really have the answer to stopping this mindset. I was at the gym 2-3 years ago, and I ran out of protein powder. So I went up to the counter. Young woman's up there, 18, 20 years old, 21 maybe. And I said, do you have any protein powder? She said, no. I said, well, can I get some? She said, well, probably won't get any more in. So I said, can you give me the website where, you know, the gym's website so I can get some? She said, no, you want the manufacturer's website. I said, why would I want the manufacturer's website? And I almost fell off the whatever. She looked at me in a very serious face, and she said, well, the only thing they'll do here is make money. Good.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, say that when you're going to get your paycheck. But you know what the problem is, Joe, that's a mindset out there too. People are frightened to death of making money.
Oh, I know. Well, what's extraordinary to me is that there's darn near a stigma on it. I've got an entire chapter in the book, in Magnetic, about what I call the single best idea I ever heard in my life, and it's quite simply the win-win strategy, which says, for me to accomplish what I want, I have to make sure that you win. The way you win the game in the real world is you've got to make sure the other guy wins. And so the only way that I will make money is if my customers walk away legitimately feeling like they have won. And so it's odd to me, this darn, you're right, there is a little bit of a stigma about making money when, if it's done with the other person's interest in mind, which you have to in order to stay in business, then it's a good and positive thing.
No, absolutely. The other thing that I've learned over the years, too, is that, you know, this stuff about they got to like you, they got to trust you, throw it out the window.
Yeah.
What they have to hear is that something that specifically relates to them, which is usually the symptom of the problem. You don't talk about stress. You talk about headaches, not sleeping at night, etc. This captured them. Afterwards, yes, all the trust and everything else comes. But in the very beginning, they've got to hear that certain something that specifically relates to them, and it comes in the area of symptom.
You know, one of my favorite things that a client ever said to me, Michael, was years ago. I was talking with the CEO of a big 20,000 employee company that I was doing some work with. And he said, do you know the reason that we have come back to you over and over for so many years? And I said, well, I'd love for you to tell me, Chuck. And he said, because you get us.
Yeah.
He said, all the vendors we work with understand what they do. He said, but you've taken the time to understand us and where we're going and where we're up against challenges. And because you get us, it makes you valuable to us. It's the exact same thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when you really come down to it, I've been, in the media for, 32, 33 years now. And one of the things that I learned probably halfway through is when I started to connect is when I stopped talking to myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, I think that this you could put it this way. The sign of a great show is when the listeners walk away from it thinking, that show was about me.
Yes.
Regardless of who the guest was, the host, that show was, they were talking about me. And there are some people, and you know this, you've interviewed hundreds of them, who tell their story, but their story is so about, you know, the universal human condition or whatever, that it truly is about the people in the audience. And that's what's valuable.
Yeah, the other way to analogize that is this. You ever met those drop-dead gorgeous women that the more they talk, the less attractive they became?
Yes.
Good answer. And those are they're the ones that were okay-looking, and the more they talk, the better-looking they became. The difference between attractive and unattractive is the difference between being interesting and interested. The interesting ones were about themselves, and you lost interest. The other ones were interested. They were interested in you, and they got better-looking. That's business. If it's not about me, and you hit it, I'm not going to listen to you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, a lot of it's interesting. The whole or a big part of the premise of this book, Magnetic, is exactly what we've been talking about, which is to be magnetic and attract customers to you. My gosh, just to go back to what you were just saying, to attract people to you in general, it can't be about you. Which it's funny. Some people, well, I think a lot of people, they just don't get it. They think, well, if I make it about me, I'll attract people. No, you won't. You'll drive them away. It's got to be about them. And you can't, Michael, and you can't fake it. You can't act like you're interested because people can see through that a mile away.
No, and Joe, the greatest example of that basically is this, that you go to, you're doing a project at home, you want a hole in the wall. So you go to the hardware store to get a drill, which is going to make the hole. So the question is, are you buying the drill or are you buying the hole? 80% of everybody says you're buying the drill. No, you're not. You're buying the hole. You're buying what that drill can do for you, and that's exactly what you're saying. If I can hear about me, how am I going to benefit? Where do I see myself within that presentation? It's called being able to recognize yourself. That's the power of a story, and that's the key.
Yeah, it really is the key. I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, and people are fun to deal with. That's the whole point. Once you get it, everybody wants to be acknowledged. You know, you grow up in a family that, hopefully they love you, they respect you. They know that you're there. You're acknowledged. So when you go out into life, that's what you look for because this is what you learned. When you go into a business, the most successful businesses there are out there today, Joe, they're families. You know, the owners are not president and vice president, they're mom and dad.
You know, they are families, and it's interesting how as businesses grow, the great ones are the ones that are able to sustain that kind of culture in their business, where it feels like a family as opposed to feeling like, four walls and impersonal. A good friend of mine named Jim Cathcart said this years ago, and I've always remembered it. He said, business, when done correctly, is an act of friendship. And I love that. I love thinking about it that way. I really do think that's one of the keys to being magnetic and to attracting customers. And a lot of that is simply the attitude that you carry into your business every day or into your job every day. It's funny, I totally believe in this win-win strategy. And I feel I got this from a friend of mine. Listen to this, Michael. He said this, and I think this comes from a lifetime of helping other people. He said, I've got reverse paranoia. I feel like everybody's out to help me.
I love every second of that. But you know, here's the magic of the whole thing. And if businesses would get this, it would turn everything around. It's the simplicity of one word. I have asked people over the years, what are you selling? And the answers come back, I'm selling myself and services and product. You know the list. And when it comes down to it, that's not what you're selling. You are selling one thing and one thing only. You are selling an answer. Period. A solution to a problem. And that's the only thing that people will buy. And from the time you get up in the morning till the time you go to bed at night, your entire world is in and around solution, even though it's used and overused in marketing and sales. And a prime example of that is this. If you're married, and I would ask you the question, does your wife fill something up in your life that you don't have without her? If the answer is yes, she's a solution. Your car is a solution. Your house is a solution. The telephone you're on right now, the chair you're sitting on. So basically what I'm saying is the only thing that will motivate anybody to take any kind of action is hearing the possibility of an answer inside the presentation. And that's the key. That's what everybody is selling. They're selling an answer.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that selling an answer or selling a solution to a problem, it has infinitely more value than simply selling but wouldn't this be nice?
Yeah. No, it's true.
It absolutely does.
Yeah, it's what you're looking for, or better yet, what you didn't know you were looking for.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, and that's really the key. The smart ones out there, I think some of the most brilliant advertising is have you seen the Nutrisystem commercial? The weight loss?
Yeah, probably
they got,
have.
Yeah, they got, let's say you're looking at the screen, left hand side of the screen, you got a woman that's got about 100 pounds overweight, very depressed, solemn look. The other side of the screen, you got the same woman, she's lost all the extra weight. You know, a big smile, life is good. It's in that split second in time when the emotional connection's made and that big aha decision gets it. And there's the key. It's like with marketing, the neuromarketing. What's going on there basically is this. We're talking about weight loss, but are we? No. The problem isn't the weight loss. What they're looking at is you take your solution and you let them put their problem on it. What they're dealing with is the job they couldn't get, the relationship they couldn't have, the athletic event they couldn't participate in, and the reasons to buy go on and on. So when you really come down to it, what they've done and a few others have done, they're smart enough to do, is they set the solution, they let the audience put the problem on it, and then they have clients that they normally wouldn't have gotten because of something they didn't think about saying.
Well, you know, I heard it put this way once, and I really like this way of thinking about it, is the most powerful you can get to the heart of the most powerful way of selling with this question. Where does it hurt?
Oh, yeah.
Where does it hurt? And that's what that Nutrisystems commercial does. You're exactly right. And you're also right in that it lets the customer define where it hurts, because they're all buying the same product, but they're solving a whole range of problems. And it's for all these different people, it's a range of solutions all being solved with that same product.
And very important, and I know you addressed this, but and I'll say it in a different way, but the most important way to get that message across is word of mouth. And no matter where you do it, that's really the key.
The positive word of mouth.
Yeah.
Well, let me take positive off of it. Word of mouth, whether it's positive or negative, is the single most powerful factor in buying decisions. There's nothing, advertising doesn't come close. Nothing comes close. And Michael, in this day and age, before anybody buys darn near anything, be it a product, a service, going to a professional, what do we all do? We go on the internet first to see what other people say about it.
Sure.
We want to see whether it's social media, whether it's Yelp, whether it's whatever. We want to see what other people say about it. It's so powerful. And that's why, ultimately, the way to grow your business is, well, I'll make it personal. Somebody asked me a couple of weeks ago, said, summarize what your marketing program is. And I said, I try to do really incredibly good work for my clients. And they said, yeah, but what's your marketing? I said, that's it. I said, because my business is driven by positive word of mouth, as is darn near any business out there.
And you know what's changed over the years? It's like this. I've had people over the years, in whatever circumstance, say to me, are you going to try to sell me something? And the answer is no. If you want to buy it, okay. But I'm not going to try to sell it. I'll set it up to buy it. And I think that in and of itself is the key today. People out there, you can't sell anybody anything anymore. It doesn't work. But they buy.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, when I'm talking to a prospective client, they'll say, well, why should we hire you, Joe? And my standard answer is, I'll say, you know, I don't know if you should. That's what we should find out in this conversation. Let's see if it's a good fit. Let's see if what I bring to the table will help you with your challenges, your opportunities. If so, that's great. If not, I'll send you in another direction. Because you're right, people, they don't want to be sold to. People love to buy, but they don't like being sold to.
Absolutely. You know, and we live in a completely different world. You know, 5 years ago, you could have said to me, Michael, do you know everything? And I said, no. You asked me that same question today. Absolutely, I do. I know how to use Google.
Yeah. There you go. Really. Oh, gosh. Give me a dollar for every time I use Google in a day. I can retire in a couple of months.
Oh, absolutely. You know, where was this 20, 30 years ago? But then, you know, but it's here today. I had somebody say something to me the other day that I had to sit back and really take a look. I was putting together my desk, and I had some manila folders where I have things, you know, in it that I'll reach over. And it was my niece. And she looked at me and she said, I haven't seen one of those in years. A folder. It's all on a computer now.
Yeah. Yeah. God. It's funny. I'm I'm still old school with some, so I've still got some things on paper. I'm looking at some folders sitting on my desk right in front of me right now.
Oh, but I'm with you across the board. You know, they can have all of the technology they want, and it's great. I will never say anything bad about it. But there's something good about holding on to the old stuff. And it's the same thing with selling today. It's done so much, through technology, et cetera, that we've lost that human touch. And I think that in and of itself, you know, as far as being better than someone which you deal with, better is the ability to touch you. I remember the old mom-and-pop organizations. You walked in, they knew your mom, your dad, they knew your dog, they knew everybody. They went out of business because the corporations came in and they couldn't compete. Well, corporations were doing fine for a while, and then they went international. Then they couldn't compete with what they had out there, so they outsourced. People started coming home. What did they do? They sat down at their desk, they opened up their computer, and mom and pop started over again. We're missing. We're missing that touch.
Yeah, and I've said for a long time, if I could have any competitive advantage out there, it would be let me be able to emotionally connect with that customer better than anybody else. And I'll win all day long.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Okay, I hate to do this. We could talk about this all night. This has been a fun interview. But we're just about out of time. So can we get a website we can find you at and where we can find the book?
Absolutely. It's just my name, Michael. It's joecalloway.com, and Calloway is spelled Callowaya. There's a fun blog there. They can get the book. There's tons of stuff there.
Okay, Joe, and if anybody missed it, it's up on our website so they can come back and find it. Joe Calloway, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Julie Hall with us, the author of What Am I Going to Do with All This Stuff? Julie's the estate lady, is a nationally recognized personal property advisor, an appraiser, a liquidator with decades of experience. This experience provides for the consumer a wealth of information and very valuable assistance, which allows them to simplify their lives and break free of too many positions. And let's say, Julie, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What is it with people? I have walked into people's garages, and I've seen boxes, and in the boxes there's tax records from 1992. And they hold on to them. They don't let them go. What is it with this stuff that people need to keep around them?
Well, you know, I've been asking myself that question for about 25 years, and I really, really listen to my clients. And the best that I can figure is that we have a tendency to collect things. I think the answer is somewhere in our DNA, back in our hunting and gathering days. It's almost like a comfort to some people until it becomes a monkey on their back. And I just think that people have a lot of emotional ties to their things. I've even seen people where their possessions, or they believe that their possessions would actually anchor them to this world. But you can't take it with you.
No. Julie, one thing is very interesting, and I know that you talk about this, the word value. It's understanding value before doing anything else. If we change the value of that box up there with the 1992 tax records, all of a sudden it could be meaningless and time to get rid of it. So is it all basically a mindset when you come down to it?
Oh, I think it is. I think there's many different facets to the interpretation or perception of value. Those papers to that person, it may be fear-based. They don't want anybody else to get a hold of their personal information. For others, it's value. Well, my mother paid $5,000 for that painting, so certainly it's got to be worth $50,000 today.
Sure. Oh, I have no question about it. Now, by the way, let's go back with you personally. What caught you with this? What was it, that light bulb that went on that really caught you and triggered your imagination where you went out and did the research, the books, and everything else? Where was it? Where was the subject for you, that special one?
That very special epiphany that I had was many years ago, and her name was Wilma, and she was 102 years old.
Oh,
and she told me to my face that they were getting ready to put her in a hole. And I was quite young, and I said, oh, please don't say that. And she said, no, honey, I'm ready for it. I'm old, I'm tired, but I have all this stuff, and I've outlived everybody. What do I do? Well, long story short, we were making a plan to do something with her personal possessions when her so-called neighbors and friends heard that Wilma was getting rid of her possessions, and they descended on her home like flies.
Wow.
And grossly took advantage of her, giving her only literally pennies on the dollar of what these things were worth. You know, a $5 bill for a $2,000 set of silverware can
not
make
good.
One nauseous.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's,
no, absolutely,
and that's
no question.
What prompted me to get on this advocacy and helping others and educating others and giving them a plan so that one day they're going to look at what they did, and they're going to have peace of mind whether they're downsizing or handling an estate.
You know, when it comes down to it, I can remember a few times in my life I've had garage sales. I wanted to move, and I was under the timing gun, and people would come over, and I would do that $5 for a $1,000 thing just to get rid of it. And then you think about it afterwards, what did I do to myself? But
right.
You do those things, you know, and there's got to be a way, step by step, to be able to maneuver through that, and that's where you come into play.
That's correct, but we're in different times now, and we're in a softer economy. People are really trying to stretch the dollar, and they're also trying to maximize the possessions that they are trying to sell. And so when you talk about people's stuff, their possessions, it's a very touchy issue because they think that they can get top dollar for secondary furnishings these days,
yeah,
because they desperately need the money in some cases.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. And realistically, anybody going to a garage sale knows they're going to be paying pennies on the dollar for something.
Yes.
Yeah, because when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, if anything's left, that person selling it wants to get rid of it. But then we go into the house, and I've seen so many homes that, you know, they look good when you first walked in. Everything's neat, clean, and it's in its place. But don't dare open a closet door.
Yeah, closets have a way of multiplying when you're not looking. And very often when somebody is getting ready to go through the downsizing process, what holds them back is that they don't have a clue where to begin because it's such a daunting task. They know only a fraction of what's in those closets and drawers and cabinets. But here's the thing. We only use 20% or less of what we own. When you think about it, we wear our favorite clothes, we have our favorite shoes, we have our favorite things in the kitchen, and so we really don't need everything that we have. And this book, What Am I Going to Do with All Your Stuff, is giving you a plan. A place where you can begin to thin out the house, and lots of trustworthy advice on how to find those resources and the pros and cons to each option.
Okay, let's walk our way through. Large collections of stuff. How do you deal with it? How do you handle it? What's the first step? What do we look at first?
Well, the first thing is you really need to have it looked at by a professional. You know, let's say mom had a collection of antique cookie jars and she's got 300 of them. You need an expert or a personal property appraiser to come in and figure out of those 300, what are the most valuable ones? Because you don't want to put a $5 sticker on a $500 piece. And so first you find out what are the most valuable. Second, you figure out who's the best resource to sell some of these, because the families can no longer absorb these massive accumulations that our parents may be leaving behind. Because the boomers, of which I'm one of them, are looking at an empty nest. We're looking at simplifying and downsizing as well. With these larger collections, what people have to understand is when you go to sell numerous pieces, you know, 20, 30, 50, 100 plus, you're actually hurting the market, because the collectors are going to come out and they're going to pick the cream of the crop, and then the rest of them are going to sell for next to nothing.
Yeah.
So it's actually, you know, saturation of the market. And so it has to be handled really professionally is the best way to do it.
And really that's the key. But I think the biggest problem that we have out there, the consumer, we don't know that there are the steps that you can take to get your way through. You know, people look at their mess, and it's just like the book says, what do I do now? And so you sell it. But you don't know, for the most part, unless you've been through it or unless you know somebody who knows you, to say, okay, this is the first step and this is how I move through, where everybody benefits at the end result, not only the buyer but the seller too.
That is correct, because when you don't follow that plan, very big and trying mistakes can happen. And I see a lot of regret. I see a lot of people trying to do it themselves, which we all like to do things on our own. But there are times you need to bring in the superhero, and that superhero is going to be a professional to help you ascertain the plan, the guidance, the resources, the options, and then get moving forward.
Now, by the way, you said options. It's an operative word. What options do we have for selling stuff?
Well, there's a lot of options, and it really depends on the personal property that people are looking to sell, whether it's a leather sofa or Persian rugs or crystal silver, that sort of thing. You know, I own and operate the American Society of Estate Liquidators, so I am a huge advocate of on-site estate sales. We're very savvy at what we do. We do our best to maximize proceeds for our clients. There are other options, too. There's auctioneers for all different tiers. I certainly wouldn't send a $10,000 piece to a small auction house. You really need a global audience for that and someone who can properly advertise it. You've got local consignment shops. You know, if you just want to get rid of a few things, you know, a chair, mom's old china, things that may not have much value, you want to take it to a local consignment shop, that's fine too. But it
now,
really
by the way, is
depends.
That how they would be listed, local consignment shops?
Yes. I mean, in the Yellow Pages, or you can Google consignment shops in your city. But there's pros and cons to each one of these different options. You have to talk about commissions and additional fees. Is it convenient? Very often a consignment shop will take an item, but if it doesn't sell in 90 to 120 days, you either have to come pick it back up or it gets donated. So there's all kinds of pros and cons for each one, and I usually make recommendations based on what I see in these homes.
Okay, let's talk American Society of Estate Liquidators. When did you start that?
It started in 2001, and I was a member. I became the owner and director in 2007 because the owners were going their separate ways, and they knew that I had a vision. And the vision was to not only educate people that wanted to go into the estate sale industry, but also a place where professional people who are veterans in the industry could go to continue to build their business, get guidance, support, affordable tools. It was just a vision I had, and from that moment to this, it has just grown by leaps and bounds.
You know, the potential for people to be involved has got to be massive out there, because when we really think about, you know, what am I going to do with all my stuff, that's on a lot of people's minds. I bet we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars of stuff throughout the country.
Oh, I would imagine so. I think you're spot on with that because, you know, even just 10 years ago, the amount of estate sales that you would see in a local newspaper, let's say in your town, maybe, you know, 3 or 4. And then you'd see a bunch of garage sales. But today, in an average city, I mean, we're seeing 50, 60 of them, and we don't even know who these people are. What kind of training do they have? Did they just put up a shutter overnight saying, hey,
yeah. You
know, I'm a professional. No, you're not. So it's also very important for the consumer to do their research and finding an expert who really is an expert. And there are ways to do that online. Check them out on Angie's List, Better Business Bureau. And, you know, if you keep hearing a company's name over and over again, oh, that lady, Julie Hall, she is so nice, the estate lady, you need to use her. And she's very good at what she does. You keep hearing that over and over again, that's a good sign. But when you start seeing some negative reviews, especially if they're unresolved issues, don't do it.
No, absolutely. So really, you have to listen to what other people say to be able to trust someone you're dealing with.
Oh, very much so. Even local professionals, such as attorneys, financial professionals, realtors, they're going to know who's good in their city and who to recommend to.
Okay, so when you really come down to it, what if somebody wants to start a business like this? What do they do? Do they first join the society, or how do they go about doing it? Let's say somebody gets that excitement, that buzz that you got, and wants to do this. How do you start?
Well, a lot of people start without knowing what they're doing, and that can be problematic because they're not aware of the liabilities and the multiple issues. You have to manage the client, and by that I mean work closely with people who are not really themselves. They could be grieving, going through a divorce, having a difficult time in life. And so there's a lot to take into consideration. They can certainly take their training through us, the American Society of Estate Liquidators, where we have very affordable courses where we will certify someone, and we offer them the support. Whatever they need, we're there to help them. But we're very strict in quality and ethics, and
sure,
we really want our members to be the best out there.
Oh, no question about it. No, okay. What does it take to be a good member? And I think that's a fair question.
It's a wonderful question. It's somebody who offers not only integrity and ethics, but compassion, the ability to solve problems, the ability to see what the client needs before the client even needs it, to offer service excellence. You know, when you're downsizing or emptying an estate of a loved one, emotions are at an all-time high.
Oh, sure.
And you can imagine that professional estate liquidators have to deal. They literally wear about 30 hats in any given day. They deal with a lot, and sometimes the client may not fully, you know, they have trouble letting go. And even in this book, I even wrote an article, Tips for How to Let Go, because people have trouble letting go. They hear that someone's died and they go straight for all the stuff, not fully understanding that their loved one is not in the stuff. You know, so there are ways to, you know, I always recommend take pictures, take videos. Remember the house that it, you know, the way it was, but it doesn't mean you have to clutter up your home, because then you're going to face marital strife or family strife, and then one day what happens is they pass the buck to their children. Do you really think these millennials are going to know what to do with grandmother and great grandmother's stuff?
Nah. They don't care.
Exactly.
No, it's the difference between the relationship you have with your mother, and then the relationship you have with your grandmother,
of course.
And then all of a sudden you got your great grandmother, that 9 out of 10 people have no idea who that was. So there's no emotional tie with those things that have been inherited down.
And another really big thing to take into consideration that I, when I talk to my clients who were in my, you know, age group 50s and 60s, I say our children and grandchildren acquire virtually. They don't acquire materially like we did. You know, really the burden of handling all this stuff is on that boomer. Because I know if you leave it to the children, just for kicks one day, I went to my young adult daughter and said, hypothetically, if something happened to me tomorrow, what would you want from this house? And she shocked me. And she said, just your jewelry, Mom. That's it. And I said, that's it out of this house? That's all you want? She goes, well, I like that Japanese chest, but that's it. And so that really was an eye-opening experience for even me.
Sure. You know, and because I think what we're really dealing with is you and I have emotions about certain things we own. That does not mean that it's transferred to anybody that we're dealing with, and sometimes it's very hard not to realize that they don't have the same feelings.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. No. And, she's lucky
so
she's
the,
still your daughter.
Well, the problem that we run into or I run into with my clients is they'll say, well, you know, I want to choose these things for my granddaughter. How old is your granddaughter? She's 3.
Yeah.
Well, why are you going to pay thousands of dollars in storage when this 3-year-old, when she grows up, you know, 20 years from now, I can almost guarantee you she's not going to want. But why not just save her a piece of jewelry?
Yeah.
Something
which
small.
Is really good.
I think so.
Julie, we're starting to run out of time now. So let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and get the book.
The website is theestatelady.com, and the book is available in ebook and print on demand version through Amazon.
Wonderful. And if anybody missed it, it's up on our website so they can find you. Julie Hall, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Laura Gentleman with us is a registered nurse, holds a master's degree in nursing education from the University of Minnesota. She worked in a variety of settings until her career was sidelined by depression. She continues to be active in her community by volunteering in many areas, many arenas of depression, and it's including in the Mayo Clinic, the Auxiliary, the Methodist Campus, and the National Allegiance on Mental Illness. And let us say, Lori, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How did I do with your last name? Was I close?
I think you did very good. Juneman.
Okay, I got it. And the book is Climbing the Mount Everest of Depression. Where was it for you, Lori, where was it for you that depression caught up to you? Because it sounds like it wasn't there, and all of a sudden one day it happened.
Yes, I don't think it was probably one day, but I think for me, I was unaware of it until a few days. It went on for about a month that I had some symptoms of just not being able to sleep. I didn't care if I ate or not. I didn't want to go to work. I did, but I thought I was having to put a happy face on every time I went to work. And work was my essence before that. It provided me with everything almost that I needed. I couldn't concentrate, and I was just having problems in general, just being out and among people with anxiety and things like that. And I was an educator, so I was used to being around quite a few people, but it just wasn't working anymore. So I talked to my boss, who sent me to an employee assistance counselor, and from there I was referred to my regular family physician to see if they could see any other reason for the symptoms. And from there, I was sent to a psychiatrist where I got the diagnosis of depression.
Now, what brought it on? Did they ever get that reason for it coming?
No real pat reason. There were different aspects of my life that different psychologists brought up. Most of the time they called it a chemical imbalance, and that I really had little to do with it. But
So in essence, it was something that happened. It wasn't an emotional roadblock that you ran into. It wasn't being let down. It was all of a sudden you had a difference in the chemicals in your body, in your brain, and it started responding and coming out as depression. Now, question, how normal is that for people?
I think it's more normal than people realize.
Yeah.
Some people can identify an event that happened. You know, they just went through a loss of a marriage, or they lost a career completely, or anything like that, a big loss or a big conflict that may lead them into a depression. But I wasn't identifying anything like that at first.
So it's kind of interesting because we've gotten a definition of depression if you're down about something. But realistically, what's coming out more and more today is that's not what it is at all. And you can be depressed and have nothing going wrong in your life.
You have to kind of see the difference between depression and sadness. We all experience sadness. Probably once a week we're sad about something, but it doesn't take us into something that it's affecting our lives in many areas. Depression takes you somewhere where your life is being affected by this.
You know, they just had, it was interesting, I saw 90% of it yesterday. Robin Williams' wife was on television. They were interviewing her. And, you know, he took his life about a year or so ago. And
yes, I saw
he was loaded with chronic depression. As a matter of fact, he had a brain disease that they're just coming up with now that there's no cure for, but it was more and more taking over him, and he was more and more depressed every day. And the doctors basically told him that there was no out for this, and, you know, one day he just said enough and he did what he did. But the point of contention is the more we know about it, the better off we're going to be, because if all of a sudden it hits, you're getting these symptoms and you don't have an answer, that's got to be scary.
Yeah, you kind of feel really out of control. You might have been controlling all your life, and all of a sudden you're not in control about what's going on in your life or your surroundings. Yep.
Now,
I'm
did
sure
they,
he felt
did,
very out of control.
Oh, absolutely. But he was totally out of control. That's what the problem was. And his wife said she left one day and she came back, got a phone call, and when she got back, he was gone. But it was one of those things, they gave him a minimum or maximum, excuse me, of 2 to 3 years to live. And that was the end of it. And that was there was nothing that they could do. So he took what he took. He did what he did. But there are so many people in the same situation, maybe not as critical, but what's scary is when you're up against something that you don't know why it's there and you don't know what it is. And thank goodness there's doctors out there that can at least get a handle on it.
Right. Because you really feel alone. You're in a situation where somebody is saying, this is what you need to do, and you may be putting out all that effort, but you don't see any progress. And
yeah.
I'm sure many people feel like that. And there are some people who go into a depression who just can't put out anything to get well either. But for those who really try hard and can't get anywhere, it's even more frustrating. Yep.
Yeah. I think the dangerous, and that's the word about this, is that depression can be very different for each individual. And if you don't know what it is, then there's the problem.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a problem in itself, is that people see one friend that may have depression and it's showing these symptoms, and in somebody else it shows quite different symptoms. And so how do you understand? It's hard for the public to understand. It's hard for family to understand, friends. And that's where the stigma comes.
Well, I think that's important also. The book, again, too, Climbing the Mount Everest of Depression is the tagline. A story of hope, recovery, and inspiration. Once we know, once there's somebody who's been there, done it, and I'm sorry that you had to go through it, but at least look at the lives you're touching now.
I hope so. That's my goal. I'm passionate about getting my story out and having people not feel alone and having people feel that there is some hope. So that's why I wrote my books, and it just is important for me to do that, because I was looking all over for information when this first started. Now, everybody doesn't have a long-term chronic resistant depression like I had. They can get help fairly fast. They may never have another episode, and I don't want to scare those people, but I want the people who really are struggling and do it for a long time to understand that they aren't alone.
Yeah, now, that's very important. That you're not alone, and also that there are answers out there. Now, it's called breaking the stigma, and it's very important because we define it in a certain way. And we say depression is this, depression is that, but it isn't. And that's what we're finding, and especially with your case.
Yes. I think that education is one of the most important things that we can do for people that are trying to learn more, not only the person who's going through it, but the people surrounding them. I had a lot of people who had to learn that didn't understand. I mean, I was a nurse with a graduate degree at the time, and I had no idea what I was getting into. And I gave my own definition of depression, and that was that depression is a callous illness that had no idea I had other plans for my life.
You know, and one of the things you do talk about, I think it's important, mental illness, like any other illness, must be accepted. We go through life and we block things. We don't accept them. And the more you hide it, the worse it gets.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. And I think that it takes a while to get through that acceptance. It took me a long time because it's just so misunderstood that I didn't have people supporting me that this is something that's going to get better, a whole lot of people anyway. You know, I have to give my physicians credit and stuff that said there is hope here, keep trying. But you do have to accept where you are, and once you accept where you are, you can break some of the barriers of the illness.
And sure.
But it's difficult to get to that point.
Oh, yeah, and like anything else, you need a support system, friends, family, you know, to start, and wherever else professionally. How do you get friends to be able to relate to you? How do you get family to relate to you?
For me, actually, it was probably more difficult to get my family to relate to me because of the physical distance apart. They were at a minimum of 180 miles away, and then I had family that was 1,000 miles away. So it was hard for them to get it. But my friends, I have to say, there were a few friends I lost that were just work friends maybe, you know. But there were other friends that I worked with, I did things with socially. I'm still friends with them today. They stood by me. They put up with me when I was in the depths. And now today I can understand some things that they're going through. The person living in depression is living a complete different life sometimes than the people they used to do things with, you know.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Getting up in the morning and taking a bath and feeding the dog may be a challenge. But you do it, and that makes you feel good. Where most people are going to work for 8 hours and coming home and taking care of their kids. And also some people with depression have to do that, but the exhaustion takes over.
You know, we started touching on this early on, you know, with Robin Williams. But there's a lot of people who won't deal with it, can't deal with it, and they end up with suicide.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did make suicide attempts in my life. I made I made approximately 4 attempts, 2 of which I remember and 2 of which I don't recall at all. It's a very difficult topic to talk about, but I think it needs to be talked about. Number one, I was not doing it to get attention, like a 3-year-old might want to get attention. That wasn't me.
Yeah.
I wanted to get out of the pain, and I simply couldn't stand it any longer. So the 2 times that I'm aware of that I did it, that's what I was thinking of. I told my family and my physician, I don't want to hurt you guys. This is not my intent. My intent is not to hurt you. I'm not trying to do this, you know. But yet I tried it again.
Yeah.
And I can't explain that other than just wanting to be done.
Yeah, but that's the point. You know, it's you can't get somebody else to get into your head and look from the inside out. You know, and suicide, I'm going to say it's an option. It shouldn't be an option, but it is an option. There are those times when life is just too tough to deal with and you want out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it needs to be talked about. I think family members have to be open. I had friends a couple times that told me they would call the police if I didn't go into the hospital with them. And that's support. That's not being mean. That's support.
No.
You know.
No, absolutely.
So I think we need more openness about the possibility, because there's just many, many people die of suicide every day.
Sure.
And younger people, older people, it doesn't seem to matter, you know.
Yeah. Okay, let's look at an option here. And it's called electroconvulsive therapy. Now, it's a treatment. What is that?
It's shock treatments, and you may have remembered way back to the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and that got so much of attention because it was such a rough, vivid showing of this treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, today, it's a very simple treatment, and I have had an enormous amount of these treatments because medication alone just didn't do it for me. I could not get over the barrier, and because I had such concentrated suicidal thinking whenever my depression got worse, ECT helped that. So I had a lot of ECT in my life, and it helped me. In fact, I had gone, when I wrote my first book, I said that I hadn't had any treatment for 3 years. I hadn't been hospitalized in 5 years. The book was out a few months, and I ended up with a relapse last winter over the holidays. I don't think the holidays had anything to do with it, but it just happened. And I was hospitalized and did have some more ECT, a few treatments. But it helps me. It gets me out of the most dismal part. It's a simple procedure. You don't feel any pain. You're put to sleep for maybe 5 minutes at the most, and you wake up and go home within an hour. The side effects.
Okay, so what is it? Was it is it an electrical change within your brain?
Yes, they put a couple pads on your forehead, and an electric current goes through your head, which causes a seizure. So while they put you to sleep, they also give you a muscle relaxant. So you don't, you're not stiff and everything when you wake up. They usually have that well controlled. And the seizure is seen to do something within the chemicals of the brain itself. So it's not the shock, but it's the shock causing the seizure.
Okay.
And that's what happens in there. Mm-hmm. And,
okay, so what you're really saying is there are answers for all of it. You just have to find the right answer for you.
I think that's very true, Michael. Yep.
Yeah.
I am convinced that you have to keep trying until you find the right answer, and you have to maintain some strength in that people are going to handle your choices differently. I mean, most people didn't have a positive thing to say to me when I said I was going to be trying ECT. It was very, very negative.
Interesting, but they're seeing it from their perspective.
Right. I mean, the reason for my career probably being gone was more from the ECT than the depression itself. But my depression was so severe that I couldn't work very well anyway. But then I had the ECT treatments, and as a result, you can have some memory problems. And I have experienced that.
Oh, well, we get older. It happens to all of us.
I know. I said I'm even with most of my friends right now.
Okay. All right. We're just about out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and get the book.
You can get me at my website, lorijuneman.com, and I saw it listed on your website today.
Yes. And it's going to be up there.
And it's available on amazon.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Lori, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, come on. Hello?
Hello?
Wait a minute, we'll be right with you. Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Goodwin Penciland with us, the creator of the instructional DVD, Herbal Pharmacy for Everyone. It's a step-by-step guide to creating your own herbal preparations. She's an herbalist with 30 years' experience as a practitioner, a teacher, a speaker, and a writer. And again, she produced the instructional DVD, Herbal Pharmacy for Everyone, the step-by-step guiding to creating your own herbal preparation. And let us say hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, and thank you so much for me. How did I do with your name? Was I close?
You did amazing.
Okay. Great. Good. We're off to a good start. Okay, let's talk about herbs. How important are herbs in the average person's nutrition?
Well, I like to say that make food your medicine and medicine your food. So
yeah.
Most people do cook with herbs, so they are already using herbal medicine without knowing it or without really acknowledging it consciously. But even garlic and onions are very useful herbs that we can use in a variety of ways to support our own well-being. So, yes, herbs are very important, and we have to remember that almost 80% of the world population today uses herbal medicine as their support or the primary form of medicine, and that a lot of the medications today that we're using today are actually coming from herbs. And now with the scare of the antibiotic-resistant era, the research is going back to the plant kingdom.
So when we really come down to it, is an herb a chemical?
Well, the herb has a lot of, let's say, it can be dissected into its chemical constituents. But
okay, there's a reason
I'm
going there. Yeah, there's a reason I'm going there. Because
sure.
Our body is an electrochemical factory. Everything comes from the brain, gives it messages to go down to the immune system and goes to wherever it needs to go to help us work. Now, the herb, being a chemical, is part of that energy process that causes us to be able to function physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. And so if our bodies are working and the parts of our body are working to coordinate with the rest of our body, then that's where the herbs come in. They're what would we call them, strengtheners? They're those things that cause us to be able to function.
They're food for every part of our body, every aspect, the physical, the emotional, the mental, and the spiritual, all of the ones that you have addressed. And yes, I think that is very important when you say that we are very much an electrochemical machine, and so are the herbs, the plant world as well. They do have their chemical constituents, but they are way more than the sum of chemical constituents. They are alive.
Yeah, and then one thing that you have said, which I think is very important, and it's, you know, through your teaching, it's the reason for creating the DVD, that there's a much deeper message that goes underneath just teaching how to prepare herbal medicines. The message is what?
The message is really to support people and remind them in reconnecting to nature and really see the plant world, the plant kingdom, as alive. And we are dependent on the plant world in so many different ways, the oxygen, the food, the medicine, the clothing. Everything comes from the plant world, and we need to understand that we are no better. We are all functioning in harmony with each other, and the DVD hopefully will help people to understand this and reconnect to nature, because it is, in my mind, a strong prerequisite
for the healing of the planet that is in dire straits right now.
Oh, boy, is it. You know, okay, you filmed this in Mexico. Any particular reason?
Yeah, there were several reasons. For one, my friend and co-producer, Adrian, he is a Mexican traditional healer and a naturopathic doctor. And so I spent several times in Mexico before deciding to film it there just because of the locality that we had and the way the energy feels in Mexico. And it was also easier in the spring to film it there because here in Canada, where I live in northern Alberta, we are already having snow and we won't see the green grass until probably May. And so there were a lot of different reasons.
Okay, but when you come down to it, what you're dealing with is that you said a word. I want to let it come back. But I don't think it was energy, but whatever it was that you said. But it's true. The herbs in and of themselves are part of the function of the body. And if you don't have them, you're not going to function properly.
Yeah, and the thing is, when it is from nature, our body can recognize it and can work with it. Whereas when it's synthetically in the laboratory put together, our bodies really don't recognize it. I'm not saying that medicine doesn't or drugs, prescription drugs, don't have their place, but in my opinion, they are very much overused. And we need to get back to the simple forms of medicine that support our bodies in their own healing process. Having said this, we have to also remember, though, that healing is a spectrum of many different aspects. If you are a couch potato and you think you can heal your high blood pressure or any other ailments just from taking herbs, that's not good enough. The food has to be in line with nature. The closer the nature, the better. We have to exercise. We have to have a positive outlook on life. We have to know how to deal with our stresses, our emotions, and we need to have a healthy spiritual well-being as well. So all of those aspects need to be taken care of if we are looking at healing, true healing, rather than symptomatic approaches.
Now, the preparations, what preparations are you covering in the DVD?
We start with harvesting, drying, and storing the herbs, and then we go into juices, water extractions, which are different forms of making teas, tinctures, which are water alcohol extracts of herbs, vinegars, infused oils, how to make ointments with the infused oils, what you can do when you create powders, flower essences, compresses, poultices, suppositories, steam inhalations, foot and hand baths, as well as seed and nut milks and sprouting. So it's a great variety.
Now, the target market for this, is this everybody?
It's everybody. That's one of the reasons, too, why it's so nice to have it filmed in Mexico. We were in a really small country kitchen, and people can produce their own herbal preparations with any equipment that they find in any kitchen. And so we geared it that way also that it can be viewed worldwide because we put subtitles on there in Spanish, English, French, and German.
Oh, great. Okay, now, by the way, this is the good one. Jungle juice. What is
that? Yeah, that's my favorite. The jungle juice is a drink that is very easy to prepare, and it really provides the body with instant vitality, and it also has an energetic component that makes us less sticky to other people's feelings. And so you always need honey, lemon, fresh ginger root, and fresh herbs. And if here in northern Alberta we can't use fresh herbs in the winter, I go and buy sprouts or make my own sprouts or use spinach. And then you put all of this in the blender with a little bit of water or mineral water, mix it up, and drink it. And it's a vibrant green color, and it's amazing. And even young children like to drink it because you can adjust the flavor with the lemon and the amount of honey you use.
You know, some of these natural food stores that we find are herbs. Can we buy herbs there, and is it safe to buy them there? I mean, will we get the full-blown value?
For the jungle juice, you always want to use fresh herbs. You don't want to use dried herbs. And, of course, there when you're buying dried herbs, which is that what you're referring to right now, the dried herbs?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. The dried herbs, there are a few precautions people have to take. When you open the jar, if they come in bulk, you want to make sure that there's still a little bit of an aroma. And you also want to make sure that you don't see little critters at the bottom of the glass.
Hmm.
So are they safe? I would say in most cases they are safe, and probably much safer than a lot of the food that we can buy on the shelves in the grocery market.
Okay, but if they're not natural, okay, if they're not fresh, then I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm wrong, but I'm hearing you say there's an element of strength that it's going to lack.
It can, right? I mean, the dried herbs, if they are dried properly, they are very good for making medicines. You can make your teas with it. They have very powerful properties. Everything is still in there. And sometimes you just have to trust that we're getting what we are looking for. But sometimes when people are working with herbs and they don't work for what they thought they should do, then they may need to look at, was it the right herb for what they were looking for, or maybe the quality of the product wasn't what they were looking for as well.
Okay. Now, this is very important. Hand and foot baths. How important are those for kids?
Extremely important, because sometimes it's very hard to get some of the medicines down. The children, they don't like it, they don't want to or can't swallow capsules, they don't like to drink the teas, and also they have very sensitive digestive systems, especially when they're much younger, even infants, when we're looking at infants. So then what you can do, you can apply the herbs into a foot or hand bath and have the patient, the child, the friend, stick the hands in the bath or in the feet in the water, and then the body will absorb the medicinal properties actually through the hands or the feet. And I have treated a lot of people like that, especially adults with a lot of sensitivities, allergies that go through the digestive system. With a foot and hand bath, you are bypassing the digestive system. And there's a French herbalist, Maurice Messegu, he treated almost entirely through foot and hand bath, and he was extremely successful.
Wow. And now let me ask you this. The program itself, the DVD, what makes it stand out from anything anywhere near similar to this?
One, that it is extremely practical, and it starts with harvesting the herbs and goes through a lot of different ways of processing the herbs, of utilizing them. Two, that we have all the different languages on there. Three, I created an appendix that is like a book that is on each of the CDs or DVDs, that you can, everything that you watch, you can actually look up in writing. All the instructions are very precisely done there. And also the harmony between Alien and myself, it is fun to watch. It is not a dry teaching tool. We joke a lot, and we always come back to, if we treat the plant world with gratitude, respect, and love, then you get better products as well. And it's very versatile.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. I think if you acknowledge and treat anything with respect, it's going to come back in one way, shape, or form. And a great way, an example, my car's name is Max the car. And when I'm done driving, I get out of Max and I pat him on the butt and I say, thank you, and I walk into the house.
Yes.
And that's not a joke. It's for real. But it is. It's appreciating everything. Okay, now.
Yeah, everything has energy, right?
Oh, absolutely it does. You know, that's where the key is. So somebody once said to me, years ago, we were sitting down having a cup of coffee, and we got to talking about God. And I looked at her and I said, "You want to meet God?" And she looked at me and she said, "Yeah." So I picked up the cup. I said, "There's God." Picked up a fork. I said, "There's God." The chair you're sitting on, there's God. See, that's the whole point. All of it. You can't let something go and define something in within a framework. It's got to be everything or nothing.
Everything is interconnected, and everything absorbs and transpires energy.
No, absolutely, no question about it. Now, it's practical. Somebody can use it, and they don't even have to have any experience at all with it, do they?
That's right, exactly. And you can pick and choose what you want to do. You can, even though it is 3 hours, but if today you want to learn how to make an infused oil, you just go to that chapter. You don't have to sit through an hour of the DVD before you find it. You just pick the chapter that you want to watch. Then you get all the information. It's from the beginning to the start. At the beginning, you see all the equipment in the still shoot that is required for that production, for that preparation. Then when you're not quite sure about the proportions, you go to the appendix of the infused oil, for example, and it's all right there in the written form.
Wonderful. And by the way, I think, just listening, I think that's absolutely phenomenal what you've done here. Okay, we're just about out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and get the DVD.
It's called Herbal Instructions with the S.com. And you also just going to say that you can find the recipe for the jungle juice on there as well. There's a PDF file that you can download, and then you have that recipe.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for being here. And if anybody missed your website, it's up on ours, and it'll stay there. And again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael, so much for giving me the opportunity to share my passion with everyone.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Take care. Good night.
You too. Good night. Bye.
I'm Michael Dresser.
I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is...
It is a wrap.